Welcome to another episode of the Deborah Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. The conversation about the future of heart rhythm care continues with cardiac electrophysiologist Dr. Raffaele Corbisiero. Here's Rasa Kay.
Hi, I'm Rasa Kay, and we continue our discussion with Deborah cardiologist Dr. Raffaele Corbisiero. He gave us an overview last month of the current, no pun intended, state of cardiac ablations, which use energy to treat atrial fibrillation and where that's going, as well as telling us about leadless pacemakers. We'll be talking about other implantables to correct heart rhythm issues and some truly sci-fi level research that might help cardiologists understand a patient's specific presentation on a cellular level. Organoids. At Michigan State University, researchers have created lentil-sized human hearts from stem cells. They're truly the next frontier in cardiac research, as they can test new therapies and theories on a real, albeit tiny, heart. But first, more on the devices we do have to regulate your rhythm with Dr. Corbisiero.
You know, a basic pacemaker, again, is to prevent you from going too slow, which is an issue with the heart, especially in conjunction with problems like atrial fibrillation. But the biggest concern in terms of devices is the treatment for the bottom part of the heart. So unfortunately, if our patients' ventricles are affected by the most common problem in the country, coronary artery disease, and there is scar, there are two huge issues that occur. One, if the ventricle is not working well, you can develop a syndrome called heart failure, where the pumping is not working well, and you develop issues like shortness of breath, leg swelling. You know, that's an issue that we can try to help with device technology, and I'll go into that. But the other is that some of those patients are at risk for the worst rhythm problem there is, which is sudden cardiac arrest.
What are we implanting for each of these then?
Depending upon the patient, we can try to prevent sudden cardiac arrest by a prophylactic defibrillator. Defibrillators, like all our devices, come in many shapes and sizes. There is a simple, quote-unquote, leadless defibrillator where we do not enter the vessels of the body or the heart itself. Everything is placed underneath the skin. And that is a simple defibrillator to prevent sudden cardiac arrest.
Now, again, breaking it down, how big are those? Are those changing? How are those evolving? And where do you see it going?
So the subcutaneous defibrillator is a large device because it's placed underneath the skin. The device itself, which is the size of your phone, basically, under the armpit. And then there is a wire, but the wire is underneath the skin, not inside the body, that acts as the shock waveform across the chest to correct the rhythm problem if it occurs.
Are we seeing those getting smaller? That seems like it seems bulky.
It is, but by necessity, in order to deliver the shock, you have to have some sort of size to it.
Yeah.
But they're working on it.
All right. And what else are we implanting?
So the major issue, you know, we can combine defibrillators with different technology to try to help a heart work better. So when the heart is affected and not working well, not only is the mechanical pumping action affected, the timing of the heartbeat is not uniform. So when a heart contracts, we'd like to see all the walls come in together at the same time. Unfortunately, if a heart is damaged, it may start to beat more like a washing machine than a pump. And we have some devices that can actually help the heart work better. The standard, in my opinion, is what's called cardiac resynchronization therapy, where we introduce wires to the right side of the heart and one to the left side of the heart. And then we take those wires, one for the top, one for the bottom right, one for the bottom left, and try to work on the timing of those to kind of re-synchronize the heart rhythm so that the heart works better. That has done an excellent job in helping a heart work better in conjunction with the medications that they should be on.
How are you measuring a heart that's out of sync that way?
Basically, we can tell by the EKG or the echocardiogram, the ultrasound, to see how the heart is beating.
So you could look at an ultrasound and see that it's out of whack.
Yeah, you can see dyssynchrony.
What if it's really subtle?
We have good ways for looking at it.
You still, I mean, you can tell. I might look and say, I don't know, looks okay to me.
Yeah, there are measurements for it, just like reading an EKG. You can tell. And it can be more subtle, and there are a lot of differences in how it presents, especially depending upon the size of the heart. That's what we've learned over the years, and it comes into play, especially when we're dealing with male versus female. Females in general have a smaller heart, so they can have more subtle differences in being dysynchronous. But they tend to respond better to this therapy because of the smaller heart. So it's easier to kind of fix a dysynchronous heart if it's smaller as opposed to if it's larger.
All right. And all of these ways that, you know, the ultrasound and the EKG, is that evolving to pick up even more?
Definitely. I mean, what you're seeing, you know, this, like, the gold standard now for looking at dysynchrony is the MRI, which is excellent. However, from a resource standpoint, not everybody has MRI.
But that would be, what, a functional MRI so that you're seeing the movement then?
Yes. Yeah, the gold standard for looking for dysynchrony. It's also excellent for when we're assessing a heart, whether or not we're worried about the risk of sudden cardiac arrest. MRI is the gold standard to try to assess that.
How about sealing the left atrial appendage to prevent stroke from all of this chaos?
So we're stepping back now to the top part of the heart. So atrial fibrillation, which is the most common rhythm problem in the world, carries always two issues with it. One is the rhythm problem itself. When it occurs, the heart goes into an irregular beat. Some patients don't like that. Some hearts don't like that. And you can imagine the bottom part of the heart, you know, instead of getting a regular signal, it's now getting a bunch of disorganized signals, may not work well. So there's the rhythm part of it. But this is a rhythm problem that puts you at risk for stroke. The reason is, if the top part is completely disorganized and not contracting normally, some of the blood will stagnate. It stagnates in a specific area. In the top part of the heart, there is a little pouch called an appendage. Typically, that's where over 90% of the clots form. That appendage serves no purpose. I tell everyone it's sort of like your appendix. It's there and it doesn't really do anything for you except cause a problem to collect blood and be at risk for clot formation. So the issue with the atrial fibrillation is that this rhythm problem always carries the risk of stroke. Now, in treatment for this, traditionally we give blood thinners, okay? And I remind everybody that these are typically older patients. They have an issue with atrial fibrillation and are at risk for stroke. However, they usually carry a lot of other issues that puts them at increased risk for bleeding. So we have to play a fine line because we're putting people on a blood thinner. Now, in some people, we don't want to put on a blood thinner because they have bleeding issues. They devised the left atrial appendage closure device. Traditionally, the Watchman device was the first to come out. And what you do is, it's a procedure, same approach as the ablation, where you go in and basically you're introducing what looks like an umbrella stent. You enter the appendage, you size it correctly, open up the umbrella, and hopefully you're sealing off that appendage, which means no clots can get out. The benefit of that is you're at protection from stroke, and you don't have to take the blood thinner.
You're sealing off the appendage, so no blood's getting in there to stagnate either.
Mm-hmm. It's just, but it serves no purpose, so you don't have to worry about it.
We don't ever go in there and remove an appendage?
That can be done surgically. If the patient has, we would not recommend that as a standalone procedure. But if the patient's having surgery, open heart surgery for a valve or for bypasses, and has the history of AFib, a surgeon can ligate the appendage. We do have some concerns depending upon how that's done, because sometimes the appendage is not completely ligated. The appendage comes in many shapes and sizes. Sometimes if you don't get all of it, you're still at risk. In fact, we've put in left atrial appendage closure devices in patients who had open heart surgery and said that their appendage was ligated. And there was still enough of a lobe left where we had to go put an appendage to make sure that they could get off the blood thinner.
So again, that's something else we're going to be looking at to make sure that,
yes,
that issue, whether we're ligating it better in the future and we have better techniques for that.
The transvenous approach, you know, that we do for the procedure is going to be better than a surgeon's ligation. That's my opinion.
Well, I'm here to get your opinion. I want to know what's got you jazzed and what you see coming down the pike. The research that you find the most interesting and most promising. And now I'm going to pester you about organoids. So tell me about this, because that's fascinating that we can create like a teeny weeny little heart and test it.
Well, I think we can, you know, use it to learn a lot about AFib in terms of what we can do in trying to prevent it. Traditionally, you know, we have the approach now of ablations because in general, the medications haven't worked, but we don't know why. I'm sure that they're going to be able to test certain theories about why certain factors affect the atrium more than others, why certain people progress, why certain people scar, as you know, and might help us with our therapy interventions. Some people are excellent candidates for like ablations. We do one ablation and they do well and we don't see them for years. Others, you know, they progress, they scar, they don't do well with it. And we need to know the difference between those two patients, whether it's, you know, inflammatory measures that we have to find out or genetic factors that we have to find out. I'm sure this will give us a platform to see how we can learn more about it.
Can you explain what an organoid is?
So from what I read, it seems like a sort of a mini heart to do experimental work to find out about rhythm disturbances.
That's made from stem cells.
Yeah. I mean, they've been working on this for a while where they have, you know, try to recreate hearts. So they have the, like Mayo Clinic, the heart transplant unit has like an exoskeleton that they infuse stem cells, and then the stem cells, depending upon where they are, start to grow. So here they're kind of creating a left atrium with organoids, and then they're able to work on it to induce AFib and see how it progresses.
Because you can't test the human heart, can you?
No.
I mean, that's it. I mean, you treat and you get your data and you learn from that.
Right. But again, you know, the treatment that we do is, you know, sort of reactive, right? But we don't look into like a lot of factors, which how medicine is going to change is, you know, what are the genetic components? Why do some drugs work on some people and not on other people? We have to kind of individualize this. And like I said, for some people, something works, and for others, it doesn't. What I like with device therapy is that, you know, for a failing heart, we have multiple ways to try to help it function better, to help our cardiologist and not just drug therapy. So we have the cardiac resynchronization therapy. We have conduction system pacing, cardiac contractility modulation, which is going to be a relatively new device that's coming out with a defibrillator.
Explain that a little bit.
Cardiac contractility modulation is using a device to help affect the calcium current in the heart to try to get it to squeeze better. So that device has been out for a while, has done a good job with helping patients with weak hearts, but it's just been a device sort of like a pacemaker. This year, there'll be a device coming out, cardiac contractility modulation with a defibrillator. So it will help the heart work better and also protect it. And it's going to be one device. It's going to bring a lot of innovative features because the device will be rechargeable. So we do the implant and it may last, that implant may last 20 years.
How long do they tend to last now?
Depending upon what it does, 5 to 10 years. Like just a simple defibrillator can last 10 years. But if you have a cardiac resynchronization defibrillator that's helping the heart work better with every heartbeat, if it's working, you know, 100% of the time, the battery may be down to like 5 years.
20 years. Huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, because that's good from our standpoint, because every time you do a procedure, there's always a risk of infection. So if you don't have to do multiple procedures, that helps the patient.
Any other combination implantables you see?
There's also a device called a Barostim device, which is implanted with a lead up on the carotid artery into the nerve plexus there, and then attached to a pacemaker-like device, which helps do what's called autonomic modulation, which is affecting the nervous system's effect on the heart to help heart failure. So it has an effect very much like the medications that are used.
And again, the goal is to deal with the issue and not be throwing all kinds of pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, I mean, pharmaceuticals is the standard. That's where you start. But clearly, it needs help. It's tough for patients to take all their medications, especially in this country. I mean, compliance is a big issue with not only the patient taking it, tolerating it, and affording it. Mm-hmm. These devices, I tell my patients all the time, if we get a device to work right, that's 100% compliance. You don't have to worry about it.
In terms of getting it to work right, what's involved in that? And do you see these things becoming, you know, much more set it and go?
We spend a lot of time getting this to work right individually for the patient. Unfortunately, your last comment is an unfortunate thing that occurs in this country. A lot of devices are just out-of-box settings, which really, in my opinion, should not be. So we've worked hard at trying to program these devices. In fact, Debora has worked with a certain company to develop a patent to how to develop the programming of these devices. So here at Debora, we sort of came up with what's called multi-fuse, which is a way of taking all the information and bringing it together to try to get the heart to work better. And we call that sort of a fusion, try to get all the wavefronts working together to be completely synced.
This is how Debora is pushing it all forward.
Yeah, yeah, we were kind of proud of that one. So in terms of atrial fibrillation, there is the treatment strategy, but then we have the monitoring strategy. So if we were to treat the atrial fibrillation, we do an ablation. Then we enter the monitoring strategy. Now, today, we have two ways to do it. Traditionally, the doctor would monitor you.
Meaning you come in and they...
We can place monitors on you for a couple of days to a couple of weeks, read that, see how it goes. We have an implantable chip that we can place underneath the skin of the chest that allows us to follow you for years. So we could monitor your AFib and see how you're doing with it. But today, the patient can also monitor themselves. So there is the Apple Watch, which has an AFib monitor. There's a device called Cardia, with a K, where the patient can monitor their rhythm whenever they want to check it. And that's extremely important for us because in the treatment of AFib, as I said, there's the ablation, and then we also have to protect them. So a lot of them are on blood thinners. What we've learned now is if we do the ablation and the patient is monitored, let's say they have an Apple Watch, so they know every day how they're doing. If they're in normal rhythm, predominantly, then the suggestion would be they cannot take their blood thinner, which is good for them, less risk of bleeding. So what we envision, you know, what the research is showing is that you have your ablation, you know, your watch will tell you, you're not on AFib today, you don't have to take your blood thinner. But if you do have an episode that lasts for a significant time, you'll get a message to say, please restart your blood thinner and call your doctor.
Oh, okay. So at least there's somebody kind of making that decision, because either we're cultivating an entirely new generation of hypochondriacs, or because how many times you see a doctor and you figure you've done your research or whatever, and they'll say, we should just leave Dr. Google alone. You know, the difference between Dr. Google making you...
Well, this is information. This is, you know, just, you know, direct information about how your AFib is doing. What I don't like about Dr. Google, I'll give you an example, is pulse field ablation. So pulse field ablation was marketed as a better ablation without complications. Well, I have issues with that because they did not have radio frequency complications, which is correct because they're not radio frequency. Pulse field has complications that we have to watch for very carefully. So I didn't appreciate the industry's marketing strategy where saying that this is an ablation without complications, because that's not true. Okay, so pulse field ablation may be better from a long-term standpoint, but it has complications that we have to watch for very carefully. There may be slightly increased risk of stroke with pulse field ablations. There's issues with the coronary blood vessels. There's issues with the electrolytes. There's issues with pulse field ablation, and then we have to evaluate that. So I didn't appreciate them kind of coming off as, oh, we're an ablation without complications, because that's, we all know that that's not true.
But when you talk about the self-monitoring that is available in technology that we, most of us have, you're talking about something that really would take the information and give you a prompt without you having to analyze the information necessarily.
Correct. The Apple Watch is excellent. We would use that information for that one point. Okay. And again, you know, we even have ways now where they can connect their Apple Watch to our IT department, so we get to see it as well.
That's cardiologist Dr. Raffaele Corbisiero. Join us next time for another discussion of an issue affecting your health or that of a loved one. It always drops the first Wednesday of the month. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative Deborah Doctor interviews at DeborahHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at DemandDeborah.org.